Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Congo Square, Act 2. On Sunday afternoon, I took Josefina to the field behind my house. We ran about the pony grass before sitting under a lone elm tree. I had a surprise for her, and a wide grin spread across her face, but also a long suspicious glare, before grabbing the three green paper seed envelopes from my hand. The three green paper seed envelopes read, Thelman Seed Company. Lilies, Tulips, and Roses, I said as she plunged the tip of her tongue between the gap in her teeth. I figured you could grow your own flowers, if you can keep the chickens out. Josefina was speechless. Anyhow, I seen you looking at the seeds at Anderson's, I said. This is the best gift anyone has ever gave me, she said as her eyes welled. She sniffled, studying a small pile of seeds she had poured out into her palm, and I asked, do you like to read? I ain't got no books but the Bible, she said. I like to read it sometimes. I felt dismayed that anyone on earth would seek enjoyment from reading the Bible, but I shrugged it off, saying, my grandpa had many books. When he died, they were all passed down to me. You can borrow one if you want. That's mighty kind of you, Oscar, she said as she noticed me fiddling with something in my hand. What you got there? She asked. An arrowhead, I said, handing it over. It was grandpa's too. The arrowhead filled up Josefina's palm. She rubbed her thumb against its sharp edge before squeezing it and looking out across the pony grass, waving in a refreshing breeze. A sudden thought came over me, and I dropped my eyes, and a slight sadness draped across my face. What's on your mind, Oscar? She asked. Nothing, I said. Oscar, where were you born? Chicago, I said. But my grandpa lived here, and when he got older, we moved down to be close to him. And that's when my father got a job at the Canton National Bank. Your daddy must be a smart man, she said. Just like you. I'm not smart, I said. Then why are you always carrying that book around in your back pocket? It's my favorite, I said. My grandpa used to read it to me when I was little. You must have been a good man, your grandpa, she said, handing the arrowhead back to me. I held it up to the sky, squinting one eye to its silhouette against the bright blue. Then handing it back to Josefina, I said, here, I want you to have it. Oscar, I can't take this from you. It's too special. You already gave me so much, she insisted. She took possession of the arrowhead, but said nothing more about it as we sat in silence, listening to the song of a blue jay. And then Josefina began to sing. She sang in Spanish, and I could not understand a thing, but it was the most fantastic thing I'd ever heard. In a sense, it changed everything for me. My intrigue grew in an instant, and my heart flooded with not only love, but joy. In only a matter of moments, I could honestly say, life entirely transformed with every word. I was dumbfounded, and as she finished, I told her rightly so. She blushed, insisting there was nothing special about it, just a part of life. But no, not for me. This was a part of life I had never known. That is very sad, she said before a deep, sudden silence returned. Then, hey, she said, come with me, as she stood, pulled me to my feet, and dragged me out from under the tree. Where are we going? I asked. Just come on, you'll see, she said. Walking through the gate and up the narrow dirt path, the porch creaked as I stepped onto it, though Josefina seemed weightless. She opened the screen door, hinges needing a good oiling, and once inside, the door slammed shut on my heels, just as a sweet scent greeted me. Hell, embraced me. The sweet scent. Warm. Inviting. Familiar, but utterly foreign to my sensibilities. The slightly nutty aroma, with hints of caramel and earth, exciting me as though I'd entered a brand new world and stepped into an exotic land. An exotic land. A tan-skinned man sat hunched over a table on a stool, much darker than Josefina. He looked up in surprise, a cup of steaming coffee glistening in his eyes. "Papa, this is my friend Oscar," said Josefina, a sullen face instantly aglow at the sight of his daughter. And with a soft yet raspy voice, her father greeted me with joy. Though I had not understood a word, I found the gladness equally foreign as he quickly rose from his stool to reach his hand across the table within the tight space. "Good day, sir," I mumbled bashfully, trying to be a little gentleman in robin's egg blue. His hand, calloused and rough as rope, but his grip was as gentle as his eyes. "Papa," said Josefina, nudging him with a certain attitude. "A pleasure," her father said with a thick, broken accent. "Donde a toro, papa?" she asked. Papa grumbled something, shook his head, and motioned somewhere yonder. But Josefina seemed to understand entirely, though at the time, I understood little more than squat. "Café?" he asked, again rising from his stool.
"I got it, papa," said Josefina.
"Sit down," she said, and I sat in a wooden chair. The room was boiling with coffee on a wood stove, and the three of us sat around the table in awkward silence. Josefina's feet, swinging anxiously beneath her chair, dried paisley petals swept back and forth in the tide of her anxious legs. I took an awkward look over my shoulder as Josefina hummed steadily to herself before saying, with a jolt of energy, "Oh look, Papa, Oscar gave me a surprise." A wide grin spread across her face, but Papa gave her a long, suspicious stare before grabbing the three green paper seed envelopes from her hand. Papa studied the three green paper seed envelopes that read, "Delman Seed Company," with curious eyes. "Lilies, tulips, and roses, Papa," she said as she plunged the tip of her tongue between the gap in her teeth, body shivering from side to side. "Oscar figured I could grow my own flowers, if I can keep the chickens out, of course." Papa sat speechless. "Anyhow, he see me looking at the seeds at Anderson's. The best gift anyone has ever gave me," she said, as her eyes welled, and Papa grinned pleasurably. Josefina sniffed as Papa studied a small pile of seeds he'd poured out into the deep crevices of his palm. I flinched in my chair as Josefina sprung to her feet to check on the coffee, which was ready, and she poured three piping hot, dented tin cups to the brim. "Milk, sugar?" she asked, setting one cup before me on the table. And a moment later, as she and Papa sipped away, "Ain't you gonna drink your coffee?" she asked. I had no idea whether I liked coffee or not, so I lifted my cup, took a small sip, and began to cough and grimace. It was terrible. "What, you ain't never had coffee before?" she asked with a rolling laugh. "My father never lets me drink coffee," I said. "It's prohibited. He says it'll stunt my growth." "Prohibited," Josefina said, further giggling, saying, "Papa has been drinking coffee since he was a boy. Haven't you, Papa? Didn't stunt your growth, did it, Papa?" she asked as I looked over at the short man, who simply smiled as he seemed to relish in his coffee with a simple joy I was not sure I had ever witnessed before. Before he seemed to pick up on what was being said, saying, "Muy fuerte," in a slightly less than scolding tone, but with a true sense of concern. Josefina poured in some milk and sugar at the drop of a hat, stirred, and again nudged me to take another sip, saying, "Try it now," as she glared at me with an ornery smile. I took another sip, trying not to grimace. And yum, it was not too bad. I gulped it down, noticing my heart beginning to race. And as Josefina's feet swung up a storm beneath her chair, dried paisley petals swept every which way. "Oscar, Oscar," Papa slowly pronounced my name. "Oscar." "That's right, Papa. Oscar," said Josefina, complimenting his English. I grinned, blushed, and noticed my own legs beginning to swing as fast as Josefina's. "I think it's a mighty fine name," said Josefina. "But Oscar don't like it," she said, as Papa gave a curious nod.
along with an inquisitive lift of the eyebrows, which otherwise were low and sharply declined inward, just like Josefina's. Hunched over his cup, he rubbed his thumb along the handle, his nails chipped and permanently blackened. His eyes fell weepy, but he seemed at peace. When he looked up at me, it was as though he was reading my soul. "Where'd you get an okay name like that, anyhow?" asked Josefina. "I'm named after my father," I said. "Oscar's papa is president of the bank," she said. "Hmm." He raised his brow again with a gentle smile before speaking to Josefina in Spanish. Josefina looked at me in surprise, saying, "Papa says your papa is a good man. He said when he got work at Parlance, your papa rented us this here house." Suddenly I realized I was sitting in my father's house. I sat a little straighter in my chair, a sense of vanity creeping up my spine. I felt proud, proud of my father. My father, unbeknownst to me, in only a matter of days, I would come to relentlessly blame for the death of this entire household. "Papa says it sure was mighty kind of your papa to give him a chance," she said. "Let us count our blessings," she said just before flying from her chair once again, before swiftly returning with a 6-string guitar that had seen better days. She handed it over to Papa, and she mumbled something that made him express first a genuine sadness, followed by an open beam of joy as he tuned the keys. His long blackened nails picked at the strings. The sound filling the kitchen was yet again unlike anything I had ever heard. At first, it was a scratchy mess, a cat fight even. But soon, a deep, soulful rhythm was born out of it, and what emerged struck a chord deep in my chest. I found myself sipping my second cup to the rhythm, and Josefina and I swung our feet back and forth faster and faster, toes touching, adrenaline shooting through my veins with another gulp. "Ariante," said Papa, as he strummed away an exotic tune, utterly otherworldly, to my ears at least. Josefina shut her eyes and cleared her throat, and I watched closely as she raised her angelic face toward the heavens, somewhere beyond the slouching rafters of the low part of town. And I listened intently as Josefina sang seemingly straight out of her soul. And what struck me in that moment was the instantaneous warming in my heart. How this stubborn thorn seemed to dissolve, replaced by a pleasure which I was not sure was real or tangible. Yet there it was, as it vibrated from those tiny bones in my eardrums, into my bloodstream, pumping fully into my heart. An excitement, an absolute thrill to be alive. And I knew profoundly at that moment that life would never be the same again. For I had discovered magic. With Papa's guitar leaning in the corner behind him, all fell silent. Minus the continuous reverberation buzzing in the electrified air, and the scent of coffee swirling about. A richness in that instant I had sworn to never lose sense of. Papa looked down at Josefina's fidgeting hands, and she handed over the arrowhead to him so that he could duly inspect it with that consistent sincerity. "Oscar, come," she said. I followed her out the back door of the house, where the two of us plopped down on a step side by side. I tried not to flinch as she jumped to her feet, spun around in the overgrown weeds, and spun her braids around twice, staring up at a shape in the clouds that looked like a hat, before slowly transforming into a whale. She then plopped back down beside me, knees in her arms, chin resting on her knee, eyes wide and unblinking on the horizon of sloping rooftops just across an alleyway beyond the chicken coop, chickens clucking about the weeds in search of seed. Just as I was to ask what the song had been all about, she spoke. And we both bit our tongues, but I nodded her on. And she asked, "What is your book about?" "An Indian chief named Blackhawk," I said. "Will you read to me?" She asked. "Sure," I said, under expressing the thrill I felt at her sudden interest as her tongue plunged into her teeth. I pulled the small book from my pocket and flipped through the pages, its spine broken, until I found a certain passage and cleared my throat. A certain passage. I started over rugged country to go to the Mississippi, intending to cross it and return to my nation. Many of our people were compelled to go on foot for want of horses, which, in consequence of their having nothing to eat for a long time, caused our march to be very slow. At length, we arrived at the Mississippi, having lost some of our old men and little children, who perished on the way in hunger. We had been here a little while before we saw a steamboat coming. I told my braves not to shoot, as I intended going on board so that we might save our women and children. I knew the captain and was determined to give myself up to him. I then sent for my white flag. While the messenger was gone, I took out a small piece of white cotton and I put it on a pole and called to the captain of the boat and told him to send his little canoe ashore and let me come on board. The people in the boat asked me whether we were Sac or Winnebagoes. I told the Winnebago to tell him that we were Sacs and wanted to give ourselves up. A Winnebago on the boat called to us to run and hide, that the whites were about to shoot. About this time, one of my braves had jumped into the river, bearing a white flag to the boat, when another sprang in after him and brought him to shore. The firing then commenced from the boat, which was returned by my braves and continued for some time. Very few of my people were hurt after the first fire, having succeeded in getting behind old logs and trees, which shielded them from the enemy's fire. After the boat left us, I told my people to cross, if they could, and all my party had determined to cross the Mississippi. The white army, within a few miles, I now began to fear that the whites would come up and kill them before they could get across. I had determined to go and join the Chippewas, but reflecting that by this I could only save myself, I concluded to die with my people if the Great Spirit would not give us another victory. A party of whites, being in advance of the army, came upon our people, who were attempting to cross the Mississippi. They tried to give themselves up. The whites paid no attention to their entreaties, but commenced slaughtering them. In a little while, the whole army arrived. Our braves, but a few in number, finding that the enemy paid no regard to age or sex, and seeing that they were murdering helpless women and children, determined to fight until they were killed. As many women as could commenced swimming the Mississippi with their children on their backs. A number of them were drowned, and some shot before they could reach the other shore. The massacre, which terminated the war, lasted about 2 hours. Our loss in killed was about 60, besides the 150 that were drowned.
That is a very sad story, Oscar, said Josefina before standing to her feet, saying, Let's plant some seeds. I'm in Greenwood, the cemetery where my grandpa is buried. I've made my way through the iron gates to visit his grave amongst the green rolling hills and towering oak trees as I search for his tombstone. It is nowhere to be found. So I begin to call for him as I walk amongst the rows of finely chiseled angels, smoothed over by time. I come to these green oxidized mausoleum doors. I whisper inside but hear nothing as my own echo is swallowed by a deep, damp nothingness. It gives me shivers and I move on, though the mildewy scent carries on. I often have this reoccurring dream. I will have this stubborn faith that I will find him, that he will hear me, despite so many ghostly ears listening, which I fear may all be desperate for a calling voice. I pass a certain sorrowful marble figure whose spine is curved toward the earth. A total collapse of will. I feel it severely, but I carry on, whispering,
Grandpa, can you hear me?
I walk the rows and plots for what feels like an eternity, the dead just below my feet, which sink into the soft earth with each step. It's exhausting, and my legs grow weak and tangle in the weeds. Endless names and dates, some recent, others so long ago, each etching faded or fading into oblivion. Little poems and quotes, little sayings that beg to be read before being lost to time. I worry Grandpa is lost. I worry he has been lost to time, calling out,
Grandpa, are you there?
The longer I look, the more desperate I become. I feel shame, as though my grandpa does not want to be found. I grow utterly exhausted, legs like noodles, long, disoriented, dizzy, trees spinning around, until my feet appear to tangle in the weeds in such a knot that I fall to my knees. I find myself hunched over a tiny bronze plaque that appears flat on the earth before me. It is the grave of a child born the same year as me. I place my palm upon the cold bronze and run my fingers across the engraving.
Beneath me lies the bones of a child, but 3 days old before his life was a lie.
I will cry hysterically at this point and forget all about why I am there. Then I'll forget about the boy, and I'll feel lost in a void, expanse of darkness, until before me I see a growing light like a steam engine in a tunnel. And just before it consumes me, I wake up feeling utterly alone in the world. And it is in those moments that Grandpa's books comfort me the most. When I was a boy, I'd spend countless hours in the field with my favorite book, and I quickly discovered that Black Hawk's own grandfather's name was Morning Thunder. My grandfather's name was Clyde. But what a name, I used to think. Morning Thunder. Oscar, on the other hand, sounds so weak. Rather fitting, I suppose. I'd read what Black Hawk wrote of his own father and his father's father. Something about that softness in which the way they spoke to and of one another. Soft, yet so powerful. And I remember envy shaking my bones. But also, something in those words giving me a spark, somewhere deep in the depths of my imagination, that maybe, just maybe, I too may one day be a brave, strong, respected, hell, maybe even thunderous. Anyhow, within those pages, Black Hawk wrote of his life, from his ancestors, his birth in a village not too far north of Fulton County, growing up to have the tribe medicine bag handed down from his own father, to him to now bear, to his later years when he became a war chief, waging war on horseback, with his band of braves against the United States of America and all its military might. As they fought for their survival, the thrill of his words would seep up from the soil and into my bones. Shoulder blades dug deep into the damp earth beneath, and I'd feel stronger in the spine, courageous and brave, ready to take on the world. That was until sundown, when I'd run home, creep up the stairs to my room, and just sit there, waiting for Oscar! To come rumbling up through the floorboards. Get down here! And with wings clipped, I'd spiral down. And I still remember something Josephina told me that day we had planted the seeds in her backyard. Love your name, Oscar. Some of us, it's all we got. It was only days later that I heard the terrible news of her death. The sky over Canton had turned night with smoke and ash. As I tore across the field, tearing the clothes off my still deeply bruised body, thrashing into the thicket, tumbling down the ravine, through the ivy to leap off the edge to plunge into the beaver pool below. I remember its cool waters, topical, cooling, and calming, an effect that found my body sinking to the bottom of the creek like a stone, where I lay still as the dead in the muck. In that murky darkness, I considered many things, inhaling water for one. But after some time in that subaquatic void, a primal impulse extracted me just as I was on the brink of drowning, lunging me to the surface with a fraught gasp of air. A primal scream from the depths of my bowels, startling the starlings from their perch, so to speak. A terrible pain echoing through the ravine. Then, with a sudden calm in the air, a monarch butterfly fluttered about within a sole sunbeam that pierced the canopy from above. And I heard Josephina say, "Love your name, Oscar. Some of us, it's all we got." My father forbade me from attending the funeral, and I didn't know what else to do but bury Josephina deep in my mind. I was 12 years old, for God's sake. I buried myself in books and words, and was only getting through school by the skin of my teeth. "What are you, a nincompoop?" asked my father. And with one black eye after the next, "If you don't stand up and fight back, you're always going to be a coward." And when I got sick of getting beat up at practice every day and quit football, "You'll always be a quitter." And don't be yellow, when I refused to join the army. "What are you, a scaredy cat?" And when I said I did not want to work the railroads, don't be a pansy. And when graduating middle of my class didn't exactly pave way to college. Dimwit, dunce, dope. Lazy, slacker, loafer, dwaddler, all the adjectives and nouns used to describe me. Oscar Clyde Olson, a name I did not deserve, according to my father. Over honey-glazed ham and my mother's bacon grease-fried green beans, of which I could not get enough of, and of which I neither deserved. Seeing I stayed out too late and drank too much. "Oh, you're one to talk, Mr. Olson," my mother would occasionally pipe in, though less and less over the years, as she grew distant and somewhat immersed in some alternative life to the side. To me, she was always as sweet as could be. She minded her business, and I minded my own, and she let me be me, as long as typhoid wasn't going around, of course. Me, a self-proclaimed writer, or a penny-a-liner hack, according to my father. And after 6 months of him and I going head-to-head, having not shared a sherbet in some years, my mother was about to burst at the seams with all the hollering. And unbeknownst to me, as that pile of adjectives and nouns describing my lack of achievement and properly aligned life goals and priorities piled up in the sitting room, up to her ears with all the, "You're pissing all over the family name. You ain't gonna amount to nothing." My mother managed to convince my father to put in a good word for me at the Canton Register. And after a brief interview with a few sample writings, which the boss, as he was called, in his nameplate said as much, put to the side, saying, "I'll look him over later," and I was hired on the spot. At first, I was thrilled to be working the city desk, something akin to, "Look at me, father," in so many adjectives and nouns, big-time reporter, until my second week on the job when I noticed a brass plaque on the wall with his name on it. My father, patron saint of patronage. Bullshit walks, but money talks. So on and so forth. And to top things off, it didn't take long to realize this dream job amounted to little more than squeezing out stories about stray dogs, hog shows, Miss Curvy pageants, cornbread county bake-offs, and all the trappings and happenings of the Fulton County Fair. Best-looking eggplants, most obese pumpkin, crafts made by little old ladies smelling of mothballs, and woodworkings made by little old men smelling of pipe tobacco and sweat. And let's not forget the occasional lost hog, lost cat, lost thumb, lost toe, or stolen candy bar. But where was the actual crime? Something more titillating than the mayor pilfering this, and the city banning that, and the stories on souls saved by the church picnic, and cherry pies, farm auctions, and root beer float parades. Fulton County came full circle as quick as a hare with an ass on fire, and I found myself desperately yearning for that big scoop, that high-rolling gangster to roll into town with a Tommy gun, heading straight for the Canton National Bank. Hell, Fulton County already had a freak show. I wrote about it all day long, but what Canton really needed was another sinful circus to come rolling into town to summon the tornado of all tornadoes, that perfect storm of retribution to blow Canton, Illinois right off the map. Now that's a story, Tim. Tim, a desk over, fat, always blabbering on about some dame who most likely did not exist. Tim kept a constant stash of liquor in his desk drawer, and more often than not, I found myself leaning back in my chair, daydreaming of crime and disaster, tapping blues beats on the city desk beside a cup of coffee spiked with gin.
"The coffee blues, I lacks a certain brand. Maxwell House is good to the last drop, just like it says on the can."
Until with a jab to the ribs, "Oscar, the boss is calling you." Tim would wake me from my wicked dreams, asking, "You all right, man?" From a corner office overlooking the post office across Elm, the boss shouted, "Wake up, Alice. Got an assignment for you. A quick piece on Old Man Totten." Old Man Totten, first man born in the great state of Illinois, which was not news to anyone. "First white man," I said. "What?" asked the boss, fuming with irritation. "First white man born in Illinois," I said. The boss, looking over the top of his eyeglasses the way he did when I pissed him off, a fermented disdain that plagued his face from the day I began. His face, cherry bomb red, mere seconds from exploding all over the walls. "Just get the goddamn story, Oscar. 400 words, no more, no less, you hear me?" I dropped my shoes off my desk. "Oh, and Oscar," he said, "I've had it up to here," raising his hand far above his balding head. Got it, boss, I said. No frills, Oscar. No frills, boss. I want a straight story this time, he said. I'm tired of these whimsical rambling pieces you slop off. Ready for copy by Friday or your ass is out the door. I don't give a damn who your father is. Not one word over. Slamming shut his door, glass nearly shattering. Maybe next time, I hoped. I dropped my forehead to my desk. I was a little shit and I knew it, but I could have cared less. I didn't care if I was fired. I certainly didn't care who my father was. As Tim surreptitiously pulled out a bottle of gin. Nip, he offered. I snatched it from his hand as he carried on. She was something else, I tell you. Finer than frog hair. Tim, I can't take this anymore, I said. Here, this'll fix you up high and tight, handing forth a small mason jar of moonshine. But it wouldn't do you no harm to get off that high horse. You want to end up over at P&O? He asked. I took a slug of the moonshine just as a starch-faced woman named Marge dropped a stack of files on my desk. She looked at me and the mason jar with contempt. Looking mighty fine today, Marge, said Tim. Marge pursed her lips and walked away, gazing back but once. Ah, she wants me and she knows it, said Tim. I swigged down another finger, which burnt all the way down. Take it easy there, bud, said Tim, snatching the mason jar back, saying, You know us riders, we the bottom of the barrel, bottom feeders, living off the crumbs of society. I can't muster another hog show, Tim. I swear I'll stab myself in the neck with this pin, I said, grabbing the pin. Oscar, you got a back-ass word, my friend. You got to write that great American novel first, and then off yourself. But try something a little more, I don't know. Searching for the word melodramatic, perhaps? Or deplorable? Shotgun, he said. Shootout? I said. That works, said Tim. Anything but old age, I said, drooling, mumbling, and rambling on about steel plows. Hell, you can plop your ass down to Jones Park if you want to hear that shit, I said. Well, you lie to your friends and I'll lie to mine, Oscar pal. But this is our job. You know, for a writer, I said, you sound like a flabberdoodle when you talk. Well, what can I say? Asked Tim, sneaking a big swig. Better than an arf-arf-narf. You know what this town needs, Tim, is a bank robbery, I said. Oh, I meant to ask, said Tim. How's things going with you and Rose? You still crying in your pillow at night? Rose, slender neck, wrists, still working for my father, and still drop-dead gorgeous. Still nearly a decade older than me, yes, but we had kept things discreet enough, mostly just necking behind the opera house or under the old train bridge. Hell, I said, you ain't gotta rub it in my face. Rose broke my heart to pieces for an insurance agent down in Dunfermline. I cried in my pillow for a week. She doesn't know what she's giving up, my friend, says Tim, a great American novelist. You just watch, you keep that pen out of your neck and on the page, and she'll be hammering trogs when she sees how famous you become. Yeah, well, not soon enough, I said. Well, he may got money on paper, but he ain't got your dimples, said Tim, reaching for my face. And word is, ain't no one can dry hump under the old train bridge like you. Swatting him away, flabberdoodle, I said, bank account is what it's all about. If she means so much to you, Oscar, why don't you rob your daddy's bank? You hate the old bastard anyhow. Hell, I got an idea. Just get on your knees and beg Rose to meet up under the bridge one last time. Some kind of farewell hump or what have you. Get her well liquored up and get her to spill the beans on the digits to the safe. The least she can do for breaking your heart and all. You know, Tim, I said, that's downright the smartest thing to ever dribble off those swollen lips of yours. That's a master plan if I ever heard one. Maybe you ain't so stupid after all. Snagging back the mason jar, moonshine going to my head. But not quite quick enough. If I could just get out of this godforsaken place, I said. You're damn near jumping out your britches, said Tim. If you're waiting on a good kick in the ass, that's what friends are for. Bend on over. The following day, I knocked on the door of a little white house on South 3rd, feeling I was about to vomit in the bushes, when a young girl opened the door and stared silently at my pale face. Hello. I'm a reporter from the Canton Register. I'm here to come in, she said. When I entered, a woman, who I assumed was the girl's mother, did not say good morning. Good morning, ma'am, I said. I'm Oscar Clyde Olson. I work for the Register. I'm doing a piece on Old Man Totten. Out back, she said, with a deep sadness in her eye. In the corner of the front room, a more ancient woman sat motionless in a rocking chair, by a cold stove with fogged over eyes, as a half dozen children sat silently on the floor. All with the same look of melancholy possessing their faces. A picture of a man in an army uniform holding a rifle hung on the yellowed wallpaper, a severe cough emanating from the back of the house, where the mother quickly disappeared. As I passed, the children lowered their heads, as one squeezed his black toes. Flies bounced off a window. The house was humid and reeked of mildew, sickness, and onions. "Come on," said the little girl, whose name was Susie. The girl led me in the same direction the mother had gone, past a small bedroom door where I spotted through a crack her attending to a young man in bed, about my age. The boy's spasming feet had kicked the blankets to the floor. His mother held a rag to his forehead, trying to calm his restless fit. His fists were clenched and his eyes rolled back in his head as he tried his darndest to focus on me. The image was fleeting but burnt into my mind as Susie opened the back door, and with a rush of fresh air, she gestured for me to exit, saying, "Grandfather prefers to sit outside, and I don't blame him." Old Man Totten, sitting in an old wooden chair, looking very much the part, leathered like an old glove left out in the rain, displaying every scar and mishap of the previous century. "Hello, sir. I'm Oscar Clyde Olson. I'm here on behalf of the Canton Register. Word has it, you were the first man born in the great state of Illinois." "White man," he interrupted in a shaky but confident voice, with bright blue eyes that darted away from his gaze to the sky and drilled right into me. "Excuse me?" I asked. "First white man born in Illinois," he said, and I grinned. I climbed the steps to my second floor apartment above the Drow hardware store, where I'd been living inside a bottle of scotch. I sat on my Remington, opened my notebook fattened with lead, and typed away.
So few have intimately identified with the early settlement of the state of Illinois that it is only just to dwell upon their character and achievements and their influence upon our modern lives. Not in empty words of praise, but in plain statements of plain truths. To this class belong the late William Totten and his son John. There are very few of the early pioneers of the state of Illinois yet lingering on the shores of time, but that of his son John and his thoughts seen with dim eyes as he views the scenes from which now surround him. When William Totten placed his family and effects in a one-horse cart, he came where the wild whoop of the Indians still pierced the air. The red man still sported over the prairies and wandered through the dense forests where wolves prowled everywhere in the great wilderness. Enduring unthinkable hardships, he made a new home for himself and his family in 1818 on what is now known as Totten's Prairie, the first white man to locate to the great state of Illinois. He was no ordinary man and is described by his son as a large, active, powerfully built man with very long arms and not a pound surplus flesh on his body. He would fight at the drop of a hat and often drop it himself and feared neither man nor beast. One of the most remarkable of that strong, sturdy, brave class who cut loose from the advantages of an older civilization and plunged into the wilderness infested with panthers, fox, and wildcats, with the barking wolves, the nights hideous with their wild shrieks and howls. Even buffalo and elk grazed upon the lush prairies when Mr. Totten came to the country, along with brown bears and Canadian lynx. But they were all soon driven westward, and with them went the badger, beaver, otter, black wolf, and black bear. The year round, his shirt front was open, and his breast bare to the summer sun and the winter's cold, and he never wore an overcoat during his long and eventful life. He was an all-around athlete, an excellent marksman, and spent much of his first few years after he came to the frontier hunting, shooting at the mark, jumping, and foot racing with the Indians. He and the noted Chief Blackhawk were great friends, and even during the Winnebago Troubles, the Braves were not permitted to molest him and his family. Even when on the warpath, they would visit him and leave peaceably. Mr. Totten was a natural-born woodsman. He knew every point of timber and built his cabin upon the vast open and unbroken prairie, covered in a thick growth of pony grass that would hide any man from view who was riding through it on horseback. Many were the dark forebodings, no doubt, that crept into the minds of Mr. and Mrs. Totten as they contemplated their situation in the vast wilderness. They could live comfortably in their cabin during the warm season, but when the heavy snows and chilling winds of winter swept down, the situation was anything but pleasant. They had plenty of wild meat, but the bread supply was limited and was often substituted with corn dodger. John recounts being destitute of shoes during the winter and the family having no clothing except what was carded and spun by the cabin fireside and woven and made into garments by the hands of his mother. These days, there is no stone left where the one-story hewed walnut-framed house was built by William Totten a century ago, yet the ancestors of a few apple and cherry trees planted by the Tottens are still alive and bear some fruit almost every year. Although an evergreen tree planted in the old Totten Cemetery, where Mr. and Mrs. Totten lay in rest under marble slabs, has withered and died, just across the shallow ravine to the west is a vast growth of oats. As a child, John says, one never grew unmindful of the perils and struggles through which their noble ancestors passed and of the sacrifices made for them. But as time in its ceaseless flight sweeps on, we should cherish their memories and perpetuate their names.
Poor son of a bitch was only 21 years old, Tim said, busy writing the Totten Boy's obituary. Meanwhile, in his corner office, the boss read my article. At the same time, I kicked my feet up to daydream a cocktail of romantic fantasy mixed with travel and adventure, career success, wealth, and abundance, a splash of personal transformation, avoiding the nostalgic, of course, instead opting for a dash of revenge and justice, all topped with an excellent heroic scenario right there at the city desk. The nudge to my ribs, Tim said, "Boss is calling you," as
Oscar
rattled the rafters, even as the printing press did its best to pound the whole damn block off its foundation. I did a little two-step to the boss's office, like the cocky son of a bitch I'd become, and threw open the door to the question. "What are you, a goddamn idiot?" "God damn it, Oscar. I said 400 words. That's it. You're finished. You're out. You're fired. Be gone already. What are you waiting for? Go, and shut my door on the way out." I took a breath, turned, and slammed the door behind me, hoping the glass would shatter. I grabbed my coat, threw it over my shoulder, opened Tim's drawer, removed a bottle, tilted it back, and swilled it down. "You're right, Tim. You lie to your friends and I'll lie to mine. But let's not lie to each other," I said as I walked off the smoky floor, but not before taking a step back at Marge's desk to say, "Here, this will help," with a nod toward Tim, holding out what was left of the whiskey. Her eyes bulged in confusion, head back on her shoulders so much so she had no fewer than 3 double chins as she grabbed the bottle with a smirk. I clicked my cheek, kicked open the door, and skipped down the steps all the way to the street. Walked into the street where the Model T's honked as they swarmed about me, sounding like a stampede of bullfrogs. My bowels turned with a sense of absolute freedom as I marched right toward Gustine's for a chocolate bar and a cherry fizz.